ask you, however, to return to the table and join the other speakers as well for the panel discussion. I think this was, again, a fascinating presentation. You're absolutely right. In the past, one of my students looked at the design of devices for children and found what you found, there's nothing going on. Because industry takes a view, you use an adult device and just make it smaller because it's very difficult to get access to the food and try things out for children. And we need to get around that. I think the other issue that Helena came up with, that actually, I don't like the term, but there is low-hanging fruit. There's stuff out there, phones out there, telephones out there that we already know that is not being used properly. So it's okay to do new research and find a new technology, but why don't we start off with using what we've got already? This is the opportunity now for you to ask and start the whole debate.
Who's first?
I'm sorry, there's no more microphone. Is there a microphone now?
No, they'll shout.
So you just have to make yourself heard.
Hello.
Sorry, can you say your name?
Sorry, my name is Leila Hewitt. I'm a social worker, but I work for a local authority in a private company. One of the things that I'm finding almost a little bit amusing is how we are considering patient-centered innovation in isolation as a health issue rather than as a person issue. And I find this actually slightly distressing almost, that I come from a background of social care of 18 years, and it seems like this is a new concept to health, and I find this also quite sad that we're looking at research from clinicians doing it, we should be looking at research being done by people in the local communities, by community navigators, by community researchers. And I'm hearing that how much help is getting from patients, but the patients have always been there. We just need to find the time to talk to them and actually find mechanisms. The methods that you're using in the GP surgeries to find information about their social environment, that information is already with the local authority. Most people with complex health conditions have got social determinants, conditions, carers, that information is already there. So there needs to be a lot more time spent to what other people are doing in the system. And it isn't just about health organisations, it's about a wider system we need to pull together, because I don't see that happening. I don't see people talking about it. It's happening, isn't it?
I think, for example, going to the idea of the tools, you're absolutely right. But for example, there's the idea that the social conditions have just given the deepest surgery. I think there was an immediacy with that project, and that's perhaps one of the criticisms you could say with service design being taken as on a project by project level, and then actually what one really ought to be doing is looking at it in a more embodied way within across local government departments. That's quite a long way off. That has happened in countries like, I have to say, Finland and also in Denmark, but we're just beginning to move in that direction. So I hear what you're saying. I mean, we were dealing with the idea of the fact that GPs don't have a good understanding of what I'd say is the background information to their patients. They have very, you know, age, it's a medical condition, but they don't have an idea of actually where they're living with, who they're living with, actually what that social dynamic is. And that was actually just a way of giving them little information in order
I
to...
I think it's really, really, really good way of doing it. But I find that the time that you've got to spend on all those people is already sitting in the system somewhere, that actually by just doing that risk stratification across systems, across health and social, you probably find quite a lot of that information is already there.
I'm sure it is, but as we hear in the press, pretty much on a weekly basis, those systems aren't joined up. And so, for example, I really hear what you're saying in terms of it would be lovely to go to, for example, the housing department, but would I be shared that information? I doubt it very much. If I was saying I was working with a GP practice, they would say, well, I'm sorry, this is very siloed. So I do think in an ideal world, yes, that information should be shared, but I
So if I can make one remark, I find it interesting to observe that the politicians recognised that when they set up the Health and Social Care Bill, it was actually aiming to have an integrated approach,
yes.
Based around people. So politicians were very quick in picking that up. Who else wants to contribute to this?
I was going to say something actually about this idea of joined up data. It's actually also one of the big challenges because we're talking now at the moment, the government's just been setting up care.data, and you touched on this idea of making data available. That's a system that's going to bring data about someone with their GP surgeries and their hospital data together. But to do that, you can't anonymise it, you have to have a link, an identifier to link the data. Now that's quite a scary thing, and that's something about human rights and liberty, and should we be joining up that data? If you speak to some of the, there's part linked to that's a big system for doing research. If you speak to some of them, they're like, this is great, we could get the supermarket data in, and we could find out if a diabetes patient is actually buying the sugary food, and we could do all of this. And yes, we could, and that would be amazing, and find out amazing health sort of findings.
Yeah.
But do we want to live in a society where we're doing that? And
no,
we're having that conversation.
That.
I think that's one of the issues around
I'm
there's lots of data
that.
There.
I'm talking about the assumption that one makes as a person that a clinician or health and social care clinician has access to the same information. And that is an assumption that a lot of people make about who mentioned. It's not a reality. I'm not talking about taking it as far, and it's getting the basics right and not going as far as determining whether they're buying sugary foods through technology or not, but actually getting the basic information so the service user or patient or person doesn't have to repeat the same story like I did today. I had to register four forms just to register my with a new surgery rather than just go, you know, I can just have it all under one umbrella. Simple things are the basic things. We talk about innovation, and we talk about it being this kind of unusual thing that we get to, but we haven't got the right thing, the basic things right.
I can see somebody behind you shaking their head. So David, I will give you the opportunity to contribute to you.
Okay. I don't want to argue with the previous speaker, but just my name's David Somick. I worked in the NHS for some years. I know my current career is, or my third career is as a futurist. I represent a small European NGO. But I do sit on a working group in Brussels on quality and safety. I've got a group of guys who just got a tender on patient empowerment. And it's definitely a new policy development. It's been around a long time, but actually, I sat in that group 5 years ago. It's all the representatives of the different countries' departments of health, as well as NGOs are there. And I keep saying, what about patient empowerment? They say, too difficult. I mean, that's it's the point about the view from a certain angle. What I would say is, actually, about the open method of coordination, I was thrilled to hear you talking about it, because actually that broke the barrier of subsidiarity. It came in about 2003, and it's meant that I've watched again in this group that the people are actually working together now in a way. I mean, all right, it's still true there are a couple of countries, as you said. The UK might be one, Germany might be one, you know, who don't like it. But the fact is, it comes on to the only other point I've made, which is, but when it's happening, you can't, you know, there are people who are early adopters, there are people who don't like the change, and the middle group will go along probably. Now, look what, in terms of our last speaker, what I would say about resistance to change, and it's a very real problem, there's a vested interest department for anything else. The doctors don't like change, obviously means it might change the power dynamics of the whole situation. But look what happened about smoking. The truth is, you can't really explain how Commissioner Byrne in 2005 and 4 or 5 got that through, and it's had such a huge impact. You know, I mean, I have a second home in Portugal in my retirement, you know, and seeing Portuguese actually not smoking continuously in the cafes, it's unbelievable. And there's no real explanation about changing public perception or something. It's just, there's sometimes, this is about complexity thing, isn't it? There's just a kind of break when it happens. And that leads me to the point I was really making, which is, what you've talked about is very medically focused, isn't it? My only criticism for a really stimulating and interesting afternoon is, I think people in the policy field believe really that we should be talking about innovation in health, not healthcare. I mean, there's loads of things you can do in healthcare which will save money, hopefully, and make things better. But really, the huge challenge is is what our last speaker was talking about, which is people don't do what's good for them. So how do you change something? That's a huge challenge.
Who wants to take that? I shall appoint a volunteer.
Yeah, well, that's the thing I was thinking about in the last point as well, actually, was related to this idea of the method of coordination, which is kind of a formal structure and all that, but it really is supposed to just be a way that normal, basic things can be taken notice of. So it includes things like just having normal conversations with GPs and with other people in your geographical area or in your workplace or whatever, and having all these sorts of conversations recognized somehow that can feed into policy development. So if, you know, in this particular place, people want all their information linked up to some extent, well, that can be tried out. It can be tried out. There's no reason why it can't be. But it does not, at the same time, it doesn't have to be a policy. So it sort of stops the worries about things spiraling out of control, because it's all bottom up, it's all led from the bottom, and if it works well, then people can do it or not if they want. So on the one hand, it's sort of a formal governance structure, but it's supposed to be a way of trying to recognize, to get normal things recognized in a way that becomes policy relevant. So it's sort of supposed to work at even such a fine-grained level as the things you're talking about, just having normality recognized.
I suppose what I would say is that I think that policies have been written for years which, if followed, would have been beneficial. It's the not following bit that I think is the crucial bit in this way of innovation gets sort of stopped. And I think it was David Cooksey who came out with the figure that said that research, once done, takes over 20 years to be innovated in any shape. I mean, I may have got the figure slightly wrong, but he said something like that. And I think that was very striking, because it isn't the case necessarily in other countries. So is there something peculiarly British about us not wanting to do this? Or is it just because we're all curmudgeons and don't want to change? Mm. Or is it just that everybody else should change but us? You know, I mean, there's lots of different bits in this, none of which I know the answers to. But I do know that the reports that people have written for years and years and years telling us good things we could do are not being done. So it isn't, to me, policy that needs to be written. It's the enactment of these things that is the crucial bit that's missing.
But I think there's also something about education. It's this transition between a healthy person and a person that suffers from a condition.
Well, I don't know about that, because I think it's very interesting. Because I'm getting so much older, you see, I've got this totally different view of people who are young, who I've been surrounded by in my previous working life. And they don't expect to be ill, and they don't know how to be ill, and they think something should happen immediately they're ill. You know, by the time I was 3, I'd had whooping cough, measles, something or other else. I was used to the fact that if I was ill, I had to stay in bed, you know, so I was lucky if somebody read to me, because that's a long time back and all the rest of it. But what I'm trying to say is there's an immediacy now about, I am not well, you must make me better, that is totally different from that which was there when probably the health service started. And I think that is going to get in the way of sensible innovation, because it's going to constantly have too many people asking questions. And then the same thing, I mentioned Bruce Keogh on the radio yesterday. They had the somebody speaking from an A&E department, and he went through who the patients were in A&E at that particular time, and he said, yes, and there's a girl here who's been scratched by her cat. Well, why the hell didn't somebody say to the parent, this is what you do, try disinfectant in the plaster. You know, what on earth are they doing in an A&E department? And I think this is not being challenged at all, and it needs to be challenged so that innovation can take place and not be clogged up by all of us being completely paranoid about the fact that we don't expect anything else to go wrong.
But I think your point, it is not about healthcare and medicine, it's actually about social care, it's about education, it's about whole society really taking this one.
Can we have...
Yes.
Michael Morrison, University of Oxford. I want to pick up on something there that there's an idea of patient-centred innovation, which I think can be really helpful and really useful in medical services. responsible for their own needs, but I'm very cautious of saying their own individual needs. There is a risk of saying, well, health, you know, health is an individual responsibility, and just that, you know, if you want to prevent obesity, for instance, well, you can start by regulating food manufacturers, setting minimum standards for fat, sugar, salt, all those kinds of things, rather than saying it's your responsibility or your choice alone, because as very people have pointed out, that, you know, saying that doesn't make people stop eating those things, thinking about what you're saying, you know, if you say, well, I'd like to be eating whatever, but I have to never eat any more fish and chips, never have another glass of wine, whatever, I'm going to do it because I don't think it's worth it. There's a trick. Health isn't a zero-sum game, you know, when by staying healthy, you know, if that's all you get out of it. That's where I think a lot of people feel that way, and I know even though I'm based in the Department of Population Health, I keep going to say public health, we've just changed. But no, we are back. So I just wanted to say, you know, we've also heard things about communities and, you know, contributions to research, and I think it's very important to keep that focus on interactions and not make health be this solely individual matter. And I think that with patient centred, that simply does mean individual patient centred. It's very easy to step from one thing to the other.
Let me start with
disagree. We're all agreeing with you, which means that there's nothing to say.
Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah,
and most patients have relatives, carers, and so on. So if something happens, the impact is not just the patient.
Oh yeah, I mean
it's
yeah. I think that's more thinking when, you know, when innovations are being designed.
Yeah.
Not, and that's some good examples of things that are not like that today that are more aware. But I've been to quite a few conferences recently, medicine 2.0. You know, let's have. And that's there's still a lot of thinking there, but it's about individuals or give people the app. You know, and that's a major conference, several thousand attendees. And, you know, in that environment, I wasn't hearing a lot about community or interaction of family or parents. You know, so I think that there is a problem in some other areas where people are trying to innovate, they're not necessarily from the development side of things.
Can I tell you a little anecdote which I had a patient tell me? Which was, we were asking them, you know, could we write this national strategy for the treatment of COPD and asthma, and we were trying to involve them. And one of them said, well, there's one thing I really want to know. And I thought this was going to be something of monumental importance. He said, am I allowed to take my carer in my medical appointment? So all the doctors said, yes, of course. And he said, so why do you only have one chair? And it just brought it absolutely home to me that half the time we're thinking on this level. And this is where, if you are practically involved in interacting in the health service, your view of it is fundamentally different to that which people are planning and using and doing. And we sort of somehow got to get these two to join up. And that is difficult, but it's not impossible.
Well, maybe there's another aspect as well. We mentioned education to get school kids to understand diet and so on and so on, but there's education of doctors and nurses as well. I was educated in Amsterdam a long time ago, medical school. I didn't have any idea about innovation whatsoever. Maybe that needs to change as well. How do we educate at university level and before that people that work in healthcare and people that work in social care actually to understand that, you know, there's other options. The current reality is something that you can change and how to do it.
I'm just picking up actually, I recently, in the summer, I interviewed a nurse at Warwick, actually, and her frustration, she was really has so much tacit knowledge about dealing with diabetes, and she was absolutely, you know, enthusiastic about trying to innovate, but actually trying to just do that in her day job and actually also break the sort of path dependency which everybody had got very caught up with in terms of the way they were delivering the service was very frustrating for her. She had a very supportive boss, but then actually, again, trying to
obtain funding, but also find the time within a very, very stretched department to actually just experiment was going to be impossible. And you could see the frustration. You think, what a loss, you know, just to give that person. Allow, again, the risk to come in terms of, well, her ideas might not work, but actually just to, on a very on-the-ground level, let people use their experience to try something differently. And I like feelings well when I've been in these environments that actually that doesn't, isn't really much space for that.
Well, David, yes, okay.
I can just pick up on that. I mean, we did a study of medical education with 750 primary care providers some years ago in rural areas where people principally work on their own. So that is to say, they had to think on their feet and were responsible for a wide range of things that they had to deal with. And one of the questions we asked them was how much of what they did on any given day they felt they had been prepared for in their medical training. And that percentage was about 25%. So for people who are actually in clinical practice and faced with having to make decisions, I think the part of the difficulty is that the innovation's not coming from their institutional background. It's coming from who they are as people and how they're able to engage on a person-to-person basis. And this goes for all caregivers, the person that they're confronted with. I mean, I've heard how many times in this symposium the question of time and the need for time and the absence of time, and if we only had time, if we could give people time, what would happen? There is that wonderful talk about innovations not responded to. Wonderful study in the BMJ all the way back in 1976 that showed that over 80% of all diagnoses could be made by doing a careful case history in the absence of a physical exam and in the absence of any testing. Now, how long does it take to do a careful case history? Maybe initially about an hour, maybe on a second visit 20 minutes, certainly not 6 to 12 minutes. So the question of actually how people are able to take on innovations that they would like to implement themselves. I mean, in a way, innovating is making a decision. It's like you were telling me today, the bus didn't come, so you take one bus and you walk. That's it. You know, you're innovating how you get to, you know, meet an obligation or get to an appointment. And when people are in a position where they can't actually make those kinds of decisions, it becomes very difficult for them actually to adjust and to creatively address the needs of that clinical encounter.
In many ways, this question of innovation and time is a problem perhaps not just in the UK, but more generally in what I think we linguists call the animosphere. And we live in societies that are highly corporatized, which are increasingly difficult to accept innovation that seems coming, as David has put it in his books, from the periphery of society. And yet it's a periphery. It's the liminality, the liminal elements in society that are very often the most profound innovators. My particular interest is methodological conflicts between clinical practice and forensic practice. And this, that sounds very theoretical, but in fact, this is in a very, very pragmatic context that I want to ask this question. These reflections began in 2004 in the Court of Appeal when Lord Justice Neuberger Kennedy and Sedley, who may know as a very liberal judge, said that I was an expert on testicle crushing in the Iran. And I was rather surprised because my doctor's linguistics. And I was the only person who was giving testimony at the time as a very, very eminent practitioner. And I was there simply to give testimony on political contexts or a particular type of torture. And it began to make me reflect that what one really needed was some forms of comparability in asylum applications, that when one's faced with someone who's about to be deported or handed over to security functions and services in the country which inflicts a particular form of violence, that what one needed, apart from a medical legal report by a very devoted medical practitioner, in which one of five levels of probability to the patient's explanation of each injury is attached to each injury. So a very clear clinical method. What we're actually needed was some form of contextualization so that doctors and lawyers and judges, for that matter, can say, well, yes, this type of injury is characteristic, diagnostic, typical of whatever grade of probability of force attached to this, of this particular pattern of injuries. And if one did this systematically, as it occurred to me, not only could one contextualize traumatic injury in a forensic context, but one could also begin to work out the elements of a system whereby the patient could themselves at some level own these injuries, at least own descriptions of them. Well, that's a banal question. So really, my question is, and a very basic one, it's really one primarily, I suppose, for Becky, is what kind of charity is interested in that kind of research in this particularly important frontier between clinical practice and forensic practice? A situation where a court will say to a doctor, you have given too much credence to your patient's descriptions of how she or he sustained his injuries. That is a very, very basic, pragmatic, and philosophical conflict, which we haven't resolved in the adversarial court system that very often deals with questions of life and death. So it's really, I found very few echoes in this country for that kind of research. I think there are more echoes in the US.
Becky, are you able to help?
I was going to say, Becky, that's quite a question. I'm worried that you're coming a bit sideways and say one of the really interesting things in healthcare, and I don't think I've probably quite understood your question or where you're quite coming to get that here, but is the differences in conditions. So now that we're doing genomic sequencing and we're sort of going down, crunching right down, we see that something we call prostate cancer, there are hundreds of different types, and everyone's actually got a really rare condition that's all slightly different, and they all need to be treated in a different way. And this whole creation we have of our health system where someone has a named condition and then they access certain treatments is starting to sort of break down or become more nuanced, because actually you now have a certain variation of a certain condition. You think about breast cancer and the BRCA2 gene, which is a certain type of breast cancer you then get a different treatment for, and that's become very much part of common parlance. But you then have a huge community of rare conditions. They're largely genetic because it is due to sort of small mutations. But there is actually an organisation called SWAN, which is Syndromes Without a Name, which are people with rare conditions that may be linked to various other conditions that may be similar to them, but they don't have a special path of treatment. And they do maybe come across this place where they don't get placed in a category of help through the health system. They're left floating about with no obvious pathway through.
Yes.
That is a very sideways
don't. Thank you very much. I'm mindful that we only have a couple of minutes left because the room is booked for the next event. So can we have one or two final questions, please?
Yes.
I hope to be in a couple of weeks' time in Tenerife. I hope nothing happens to me. But if something does happen to me, I would like a doctor in the hospital to have full access to my patient records. Well, this is not going to happen. We have a problem in the world. This question has been touched on by a few people here. The IT system, my speaker's an IT person, the IT system that we have, various implementations have failed in the past, so we're almost back to square zero. I heard the references to Scandinavia. I have been told that countries like Korea have a very good system where hospitals can interrogate other hospitals' medical systems. Don't know if that's true or not. The one thing that does exist in the world, universally, as an example, is Google. I can access anything. I can access my agenda. I can access all sorts of things anywhere in the world. The infrastructure already exists. All we need is some very capable organization. It's an international organization that is setting up a system that works throughout the world. I know people are going to say, oh, Google, NSA, they'll be looking at my personal records. Well, there are occasions when I'm abroad, when I want people to access my records.
Well, I suppose I think of it the other way around. I don't want somebody to be doing this to me. I want to own my records, and I want to have them with me. I don't know why it is that if I was pregnant, I'm thought to be trustworthy enough to have my records, but as soon as I've had a baby, I go back to being an infant myself and can't have the record. If you had it all on a USB stick or whatever,
well,
you wouldn't go anywhere. It didn't matter. Somebody would deal with it.
And that technology exists already. It's just we don't use it. I mean, computer chips, we put them in our dogs to get them across the channel, right? You can put it, you can carry all your own information.
In Portugal, they've just developed an app because of people moving across the different that is my health passport. It just gives basic medical stuff.
I'm going to use the chair's privilege and make two final remarks. I was test driving a system called NHS Direct because I wanted to come up with a research proposal. So, being an ex-doctor, I can fake the symptoms of an acute heart attack. You go to NHS Direct and you fill in the symptoms, and it took me about 15 minutes, and the system said, red flag, you know, phone 999. Now, if this was for real, I had to phone 999, repeat exactly the same stuff. In the meantime, I could be dead. The ambulance would then turn up. I would have to repeat exactly the same stuff. In the meantime, I could die. So the system's fine in place, but I'm joined up. Remark number one. Remark number two, it takes two people to tango this innovation. Minimal. Maybe one. A patient and an innovator. Think about the innovator. The innovator, it's not just a process, it's a person as well. I think, passionately, one of the biggest innovators, Steve Jobs, made lots of this technology visible. Possible. But, you know, he was a sociopath, possibly a psychopath. If you look at his biography, he was not accepting current reality. He was continuously driving for a better world. So I think it's important that we realize it's the patient that is a sociopath. It's there the thought for the poor person that is taking these on and actually making, as Steve Jobs would say, a dink in the universe, because that's what we're talking about. We are going to change. Okay, we are going to spend some time afterwards. I think there's refreshments, wine, and so on. So, as I said, we have to vacate the room. But please, if you have the time, stay there. Thank you very much.